All right, here we go on a Friday. It is Cody and Gold, Alex Gold, Drew Nixon, or I guess the morning show is now calling him Richard Nixon. Something happened towards the end of their show. We'll find out what that is. Drew Nixon is producing the show. Logan Weber filling in for Cody today. Logan, what's going on, man? You and I, it's been a couple months, I feel like, since you and I did the show together.
Royals baseball has been just a catastrophe for my evenings, but I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to find out why Drew's getting called Richard Nixon. Are you or are you not a crook, Drew?
Yeah,
that's what I want to know.
He doesn't have his headphones on yet. He doesn't know anything. You can say anything you want about him right now. He cannot hear anything
I'm not paying attention.
He's not ready yet. He's not ready. I think I know it was in relation to. We will discuss it later on in the show. There was some comments from a quarterback in the National Football League. And you can probably guess what direction that is heading in. So we'll get to that a little bit later on. You guys can always interact on the Jay Southland's host service text line, 913-586-7965. Video stream will be up and running here momentarily, if not already, on YouTube, Twitch, X, and Facebook. You guys can interact over there in the Twitch chat as well. Coming up in about a half hour, we'll check in with Jake Eisenberg. You mentioned the Royals. We'll talk a little Royals baseball with Eisenberg coming up at 10:30. At 11 today, Matt Verderam will join us. We'll discuss his thoughts as camp wrapped up yesterday for the Kansas City Chiefs. We'll also talk some bigger NFL topics, some of the other preseason headlines, including Mendoza and the Raiders last night, that pick six that Mendoza threw to the Houston Texans we'll get into. And then even a little bit later on in the day, we will talk about college football. Looking forward to that. It's coming up, guys. A week from tomorrow is week zero. And so John Kurtz will join us for our fan club Friday. He's our guest today. John Kurtz does the Open for Business newsletter. Of course, went to Kansas State as well, has covered the Kansas State Wildcats for many, many years prior to doing the Big 12 show that he has. And so we'll talk about KU, K-State, MU, college football as a whole a little bit later on in the show. But let's start with tomorrow, preseason game number two, Chiefs in Tampa. I haven't checked the latest forecast. I know at one point there was supposed to be like maybe thunderstorms during it. Hopefully the weather is good enough to where we don't have any delays. We don't need delays for our preseason football game. That's the worst thing that could happen. The game will be right here on 96.5 The Fan. Does the players that you're interested in, does it change from week one to week two? Because we all had, I think, going into preseason game one, like I was really interested in seeing Emmett Johnson and interested in seeing Peter Woods. And those are two players we know are going to play a lot still tomorrow, Logan. But for me, because of the Ashton Gelati injury, and I know Nate Taylor's reporting that the Chiefs were very optimistic that maybe he won't miss any games, right? That he could be ready week one. We'll see. I hope that's the case. But because of that injury, honestly, the player I'm most interested in watching is R. Mason Thomas. And it's one, how much do they play him now? Because do you protect him a little bit? So does this hurt his ability to play a bunch of snaps? If not, just what does he look like? He had really the one or two plays against the Rams that stood out. The one on the was essentially almost like a Hail Mary play where you saw the speed. A speed rusher that we haven't really seen in this system probably since what? D. Ford, Tom Bali days in terms of just that kind of speed rusher. So he's maybe number one on my list now only because I was already concerned about the edge rushers, and then now you maybe are going to miss time with Gelati.
I completely agree with you. There are other guys that come to mind, and we may discuss them a little bit later on. But, I mean, this is something that I talked about a couple of different times during After Hours last night. I think the last thing that I want to see, the last thing that I think a majority of Chiefs fans want to see, as good a camp as he's had, as much as they've talked him up over the last 3 weeks, I don't buy FAU contributing to this football team. I just don't. I'm sorry. I've watched the guy for 3 years do little to nothing from a productivity standpoint since the Chiefs drafted him in the first round. If I have to watch Felix and Onyedike Uzomah get announced with the starting defense week one, I'm going to freak out. And so I think that puts a ton of pressure on R. Mason Thomas to kind of solidify that spot for the time being, because the Ashton Gelati thing, I mean, Nate Taylor's saying he may not miss any time, but the ruptured patella fascia is such a weird injury.
Like plantar fascia or whatever.
It can be a 3 week thing. It can be a 2 month thing. It's just this awkward situation where like Peyton Manning got the injury back in like 2015 and missed 2 months. I mean, he missed six games that same season, but then there's other guys who play through it. Kyle Isbell for the Royals, same injury. And he was on the IL for 2 months. So how this thing ultimately plays out, is it a partial tear, a full tear? We don't know. And that puts even more onus on to figuring out just how much R. Mason Thomas is able to contribute. And then you have to come to grips with the idea of playing two rookie defensive tackles or defensive linemen a huge chunk of snaps early on in the season, which is completely against the ethos of Steve Spagnuolo and Andy Reid.
Yeah, I just think if Gelati ends up missing time, and hopefully he doesn't, I just think we end up seeing more Emmanuel Ogba than anybody maybe was planning on. And I know he was just a late camp signee. He's a vet. I think people get annoyed with the young guys not getting more playing time. It should be R. Mason Thomas, but I wonder if it would result in Emmanuel Ogba playing a bit more. But so R. Mason Thomas would be high on the list for tomorrow. Once again, though, I think I want to see more from Emmett Johnson. He was one of the standouts in the first preseason game, but the biggest question for him, if you're someone that wants him on the field more, if you're watching him in the first preseason game and maybe watching him tomorrow, and you say, hey, he's got great vision, he's got some juice, why wouldn't he be the number two back? The biggest thing you should be wanting to see happen tomorrow then is when the Bucs blitz, and if hopefully the Bucs do with Todd Bowles, hopefully they're not just so vanilla that they don't, but when they blitz, can Emmett Johnson pick up the linebacker? Can he pick up the corner that's coming on a blitz? Can he protect in passing downs? If he can get the coaching staff's trust in that, that's how he gets on the field more. Because it's not just as simple as, hey, when the ball's in his hands, does he look explosive or whatever? We've seen that. We saw it in Nebraska. But the pass protection was the big question there. And that is the path for him getting on the field more. Otherwise, I think you'll see way more Amari DiMercato early in the season. And he's not as explosive as somebody like Emmett Johnson. So that to me would be a player once again, but not even so much. I don't even need to see Emmett Johnson have, you know, another 50 plus yard day on the ground tomorrow night. I want to see if there's a couple spots where he's correct in picking up a blitz. He does that. That's his path onto the field this year.
I'm not sure that they haven't already done this, but if they haven't, I would urge the Kansas City Chiefs, Andy Reid, Eric Bieniemy, sit down and force feed Emmett Johnson some Jerick McKinnon clips, because everybody talks about his ability to catch the ball out of the backfield, and I think that's why he's beloved for his time in Kansas City. But what made Jerick McKinnon such a good third down back and what solidified him as that number two during his time with the Chiefs was exactly what you're talking about. He was so good in pass protection and in picking up blitzes late in games, or late in terms of the progression of a play. And then if he loses that one-on-one, then he slips out. And I mean, that's half of what he did in terms of his pass catching, was just a blitz pickup and then slipping off of it and giving Mahomes a late option. I completely agree with you. I think that that's somewhere where he fits. The guy that I'm kind of looking at the most, and it's because of the things that are going on in the position group around him, I look at Khalil Benson and his performance in week two of the preseason in week three as even more important. Because while I'm less concerned about what's going on with Josh Simmons, I can't help but be a little bit wary of this Trey Smith thing. It feels like a chronic issue that he's dealing with at this point after a ton of health early on in his career. But if you're dealing, I mean, Josh Simmons isn't going to play on Saturday, maybe out of an abundance of caution, but it's the same back issue that he was kind of hampered with at times last year. Trey Smith is going to miss time. And I think that kind of thrusts Khalil Benson into a situation where if Josh Simmons does miss time, even if Jalen Moore wins the right tackle job, which I'm not convinced he has.
Oh, see, I think that's interesting. Like, we can get back to that. Yeah. I think that job's wrapped up though. Yeah.
Jalen Moore's going to have to play left tackle now because Simmons is out, and that makes Khalil Benson your starting right tackle. We've seen Khalil Benson actually spend some time playing right guard. So if Trey Smith misses time, is it Khalil Benson? Is it Mike Caliendo? I don't know. I feel like we need to get more answers on who Khalil Benson can be as a player, because unfortunately, injury issues are already happening for the Chiefs offensive line, and he may be thrown into a position that the Chiefs have to know if he's prepared for.
Yeah, the O-line's banged up, no doubt. And once we saw the injury status and not practicing earlier in the week, it was no surprise to learn yesterday officially that Trey Smith and Josh Simmons are not playing on Saturday. Where I agree with you would just be the Khalil Benson part. I'm excited that he's going to play right tackle tomorrow and Jalen Moore would play left tackle, because that's what we've seen at practice due to the injuries. And so in the first preseason game, we only saw Benson at right guard. We did not see him shift out to the tackle. So I do want to see Benson get some right tackle snaps, especially against what appears to be the Bucs starting a lot of their ones. So maybe it's a drive or so. So that part of it, I'm also intrigued by. I disagree. I think the right tackle spot is Jalen Moore's in week one. I don't think there's a competition there anymore. And maybe, look, maybe it was trending in the opposite direction, but once Trey Smith got hurt and they had to immediately start having Khalil Benson play right guard a lot at practice and last week in the preseason game, I think that ended any chance of week one starter being Khalil Benson at right tackle. Maybe later on in the year, if Jalen Moore, you know, obviously injury or not performing well, maybe we see that. But I don't think week one Benson's right tackle, unless you tell me that Josh Simmons is missing time. Well, then, of course, Jalen Moore is clearly the backup left tackle, not Pole. And Pole's also had an injury or two during.
Yeah.
Or I guess it was dehydration. So was the reason why he left practice, in fairness. Benson would be someone I'll be watching a little bit tomorrow. And we all know that Justin Fields will get the first reps. And then we'll see Garrett Nussmeier, who I know we're going to talk more about later on in the hour, because I thought he was pretty impressive in preseason game number one, and a big reason why they're going to have to cut the roster somewhere else, because I think they're going
to
keep three quarterbacks for the first time instead of just doing two on the active and having a practice squad guy. I think they'll have still Oladokun on the practice squad, but have to keep Garrett Nussmeier, because I don't think Nussmeier would make it through the waiver wire or anything like that, based on how he performed. And I remember where he was viewed as a draft prospect prior to the injury a year ago. We'll get back into some Chiefs coming up, guys, in just a bit. We also have Jake Eisenberg in 20 minutes, but I do want to discuss the biggest news in Kansas City yesterday, which was centered around the Royals and their downtown stadium. We had a city councilman, Wes Rogers, on the show earlier in the week discussing what was going to transpire on Thursday, which was going to be a full city council vote. That's exactly what happened. And we all know it was approved by the city council 11-1 officially, I think. Somebody abstained, so it was 11-1 in favor of the package of $600 million commitment toward a new Royal Stadium. Overall, it's that $1.9 billion plan, and an estimated it basically becomes 60% of the project of cost, up to $1.9 billion, or an estimated $1.14 billion. Private funding covers the other 40%, which is basically $760 million. And we've been discussing stadium stuff for years at this point in time. This is the biggest step moving forward. It all appears that we are headed towards a downtown stadium and that they have the financing. They still have to figure out, though, where the TIF districts and the borders are exactly going to be. I think some of those documents might come out today. But what was interesting to me was something the mayor said, actually, on another station. He was actually on KCMO Talk Radio yesterday. And they had the mayor on, and I'll play you the audio of it. And it was interesting, something that has not been discussed as much in other places, which is still the possibility, even with the vote yesterday, the possibility that there is the petition that moves forward and that there is still a public vote. Yesterday, depending on who you talk to, some people think that ends that chances of that. But this is the mayor himself. This was Mayor Q on KCMO Talk Radio yesterday.
What I would say is actually be somewhat fair. We're going through lots of the steps in connection with it. This is not one state legislative vote one day, a city council ratification like you've seen in other jurisdictions, and then you're all out of it. This is actually something where we will go through a number of steps, and what's more, the public gets their vote. And so, you know, I think if the question just is, you know, are there enough safeguards? Are there enough checks? Kansas City, it's chartered. The Missouri laws allow it. We're going through all of those steps, but nothing restrains our ability to keep doing work along the way.
What do you mean, though, the public gets their vote?
I think the petitioners, as I read the law right now, the petitioners are entitled to presentment of that issue on a future ballot. That's what I'm saying. There are some who are suggesting otherwise. I haven't read the work. I did see that, you know, some interesting other cases out of Missouri yesterday. But look, we believe in our charter, and I think we're going to make sure we follow it to a T.
So that was interesting to me. That was Mayor Q on KCMO Talk Radio yesterday. He acknowledged that others disagree, but that's the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, acknowledging that he believes, in the way he's reading it, that there is still the real possibility that we're going to have some form of a public vote, despite the city council passing what they have.
Yeah.
That was really interesting to me. And I feel like nobody's discussing that enough.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's being thrown around sort of like haphazardly. People are just kind of being like, oh, well, I guess there might still be a vote on it. But it kind of feels like the grand scheme of it is people believe it's kind of a foregone conclusion that this thing is going to happen. And the announcement today was like, great, downtown baseball is coming to Kansas City officially. And it's like, well, no, not necessarily. As Mayor Q points out, there could still be a public vote on this thing. There's still zoning restrictions that need to be passed. There bond financing and different tax things. So, I mean, this thing is not absolutely a done deal. I absolutely get people that hate the idea of giving a professional sports organization and a billionaire owner money to build a new stadium. I get it. And I agree with it to a certain extent. But can Missouri just kind of like look inward? Can we just, Jackson County, can we just focus up for a moment and realize that that's just the way it kind of is now? I mean, look at what Kansas gave the Kansas City Chiefs for their new stadium over there in KCK. The state of Kansas is giving $1.9 billion to the Chiefs for their project. Kansas City is giving $600 million. I mean, it's a third of the price for downtown baseball in Kansas City and what's going to become a $300 million entertainment venue that is going to be a huge economic boon for the city itself. I feel like there is some serious false outrage with this story, and I hate the fact that people are putting me in a position to defend a billionaire, which I don't enjoy.
So what's your issue, I guess, then, with how people are reacting to it?
I mean, just the fact that there's this push for a public vote on it in the first place, I don't necessarily understand the appeal of that. We've been there, done that, and that's what caused the Chiefs to go to Kansas in the first place. I agreed with that sentiment. I would have voted no the same way that the bill ultimately came down. But this isn't a situation where the city is going to be paying $1 billion plus, $1.9 billion, the way that the state of Kansas is with these star bonds for the Chiefs' new stadium and all these weird tax incentives and things that are going to be able to bypass with the Hunt family with this new stadium. I just think that, yes, there's reasons to complain, but at a certain point, you kind of have to realize that this is sort of the way that it is. I mean, look at any stadium that's been built in the last 10, 15 years
in
professional sports. Has the city, county, or state paid some level towards that new stadium? Yeah, and possibly a much bigger chunk than what Kansas City might be doling out for the Royals here.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Look, I'm very much pro downtown baseball, but we've been talking about for years on the show. I want downtown baseball. I'm excited that it looks like we are heading in that direction. I will still say, and I know some disagree with me, I still think, despite how underwhelming the Chiefs renovation plan was at the time, a couple years back on the Jackson County vote that had the Royals downtown location, of course, that changed last minute and everything in the crossroads. You cannot convince me. I think that Mayor Q yesterday said that he thinks this is a better deal than the one Jackson County voted no on a couple years ago. I just disagree with that entirely. I understand this is for one team, not for two. And I think overall for the metro area, it's better that one's on one side of the state line and one's on the other. So it kind of spreads out the tax burden for everybody in the entire metro versus one county trying to prop up two teams. However, I still think if you look overall, and we'll find out more with the bonding and exactly where the districts are at, I find it hard to believe that financially you're telling me that the Royals downtown stadium and the original 3/8 cent sales tax extension from that Jackson County vote that failed miserably by 16 points, that was a worse deal than the one that just got approved. I totally disagree with that. So all the leverage went to the Royals and Chiefs the minute that vote failed.
So if they did have a vote and it failed, then what are we looking at? Are we looking at them actually leaving? Like if it actually happens, like let's say the least likely scenario happens and they go to a vote and like what happened last time, it's voted down. We're not worried about that because it hasn't happened yet. But is that a scenario now that it's being presented as potentially real? What is the result of that even happening?
The Nashville Royals. That's the result.
Yeah, I don't know. I also would say the comments were interesting, but I still think
unlikely to happen.
I still don't think that. I think that's also a little bit of pushback towards the criticism he was facing in the last week or so. And when we asked even Councilman Wes Rogers about, which was the feeling that this thing got pushed through so quickly this week to try to avoid a ballot petition. I feel like that answer yesterday from Q was a little bit of like, oh, I'm willing to do. I feel like that was more of a CYA than perhaps anything, but yeah, I mean, if it actually ever got to one, I don't know what the result of the vote would be. It would be fascinating. It would be different than the vote 2 years ago, just because it's a standalone. Also, at this point, you know already one team has left your city and gone to the other side of the state line. So there's a little different sense of reality. But I still think it's very unlikely we would ever get to that. I think that was also the mayor just trying to act as if he's he's still for the, you know, the will of the people. If the vote is necessary, then the vote's necessary. Let them go. I feel like that was a little CYA.
Yeah, I completely agree. He's covering all of his bases a little bit. I'm with you. I don't think it'll ever happen, but if it were to come to fruition, I don't think the Royals would belong in Kansas City anymore. And somebody said, let them leave. Then there are no Royals fans in Nashville and the team will collapse. Were there Dodgers fans in Los Angeles when they moved from Brooklyn? How many Raiders fans were walking around Las Vegas before they, I don't understand how many A's fans were in Vegas prior to them announcing their move. The fan bases come once the team is there. I don't really get the sentiment of where you're going with that. That really has no bearing on what happens. The fan base comes after they hit a new location.
Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll talk some Royals baseball away from the stadium stuff. We'll talk what's going on the field, including Michael Garcia. Once again, looks like he's about to head back on the IL, according to Matt Quatrero's comments yesterday. They think that's where he's headed. I haven't seen if that's official yet, but I believe that was the expectation after yesterday's game. We'll talk more about that with Jake Eisenberg here in a bit. Do want to pivot to the NFL. There were a couple preseason games last night, and I don't know about you. I watched very, very little. I watched maybe a quarter of the Raiders game. And I did see, though, the pick six that Fernando Mendoza threw to the Texans. And as a Chiefs fan, it definitely made me very happy because I've been consistent that
you're going to have you over preseason pick sixes?
Absolutely, because I think Fernando Mendoza, even if he eventually, which he will be, the starter there in Vegas, not week one, but eventually, he's not going to ever be viewed as a top 10 quarterback. And so it's going to be just like Bo Nix, which is great. And it's going to be, hey, they got a good enough quarterback that he'll have to get an extension, but not a threat to you actually in your division long-term. It's the beautiful, the Chiefs in the AFC West, other than maybe you want to make a case for Herbert, although he's got plenty of his own problems, they don't have a Josh Allen or a Burrow or a Lamar Jackson or anybody like that in their division. And that's always good. The worst thing is for Mendoza to just suck right away and they have to pivot a new quarterback in 2 years and then they get to go try another quarterback. The best thing is being average for if you're the Chiefs watching Bo Nix or watching Mendoza down the road. That's what you should all be hoping for. You should hope Mendoza is good enough to be there for a bit, but not good enough to ever be a threat. Anyway, Mendoza was still very, very entertaining yesterday, and he continues to be must listen to after every game or in game, I guess, as well. Fernando Mendoza was on ESPN with Laura Rutledge during the game.
Okay, well, you nailed it. We'll go tell Kirk that you did a great job.
Thank you. Please do. Please do. And please tell Mr. Buck I say hello.
Oh, we love it. There you go. What about Mr. Aikman?
Oh, of course. I mean, he's a legend, you know. I think Mr. Buck needs some more love because, I mean, Mr. Aikman's already, you know.
Well said, Fernando. You nailed it.
Thank you. God bless.
Mr. Buck.
I love Fernando Mendoza.
I mean, he's great.
He's awesome.
He's great. He's you know, this is who he was in Indiana and in his interviews.
He's given some gems throughout training camp, too, guys.
Yeah, I will play that, too, because, look, I can't tell now. That the more I hear him talk to, I'm like, he's very likable. I told you it sucks seeing it up on the Raiders because I have to root against him and hope he's not any good. But at the same time, the more I hear him talk in the answer where, you know, basically like filibustered in one of these answers here in a second, I can't tell. He's either going to turn out to be way better than we think, or I think there's a chance he just sucks and he's going to be out of the league very quickly. I can't tell. My guess is, again, he's like Bo Nix. He's very average. Maybe he ends up maybe turning into Kirk Cousins and has a couple really strong years. I don't know. But I can't. The more I hear him, I'm just wondering, is this guy going to just be one of those guys? We're like, what? Remember when that dorky guy was drafted by the Raiders? I just wonder if that's what we're saying 10 years from now. I don't know. Here was another answer he gave at training camp, though.
Yeah, I would say that it is tough. However, everything that is tough, you wouldn't want something to be easy. If it's tough, it's worth it. And that's why it works at the highest level. And it's great because the teammates, we rely on each other. They rely on the receivers to make the right timing, right route. The receivers rely on the quarterback to throw in the correct timing. The linemen rely on the quarterback to get it out on time. The quarterback rely on the linemen to give them that time to throw it. And then the tight end, I mean, there's so many different variables to it. And when we all rely on each other, I believe it makes us closer. And when we become one oiled unit and we have all this synergy and become a dynamic ecosystem where we're evolving together, playing on time, be able to make, and then still say make some off-schedule plays, but mostly playing on time, then that's what teams in this system take the next level.
Just word, just
I
word,
love it.
Just
I
word,
love
word
it.
Salad for 47
just,
seconds.
Just go, Fernando.
Buzzwording the hell out of it. Just a straight-up LinkedIn post.
Yeah, ecosystem, synergy. What did he even, did anybody know what he actually said there? Anybody know what he was trying to say?
Talking about absolutely how when they play not together and uh-huh go through adversity, it can help build the team up a little uh-huh bit. I love it.
I also like that he was trying to say well-oiled machine, yeah, and he just forgot well. Whoa, he just said, we're going to be an oiled machine. I was like, what? Huh? Synergy?
He's entertaining.
Where are we going with this?
This is all apparently, by the way, who he is.
Yes. Like,
there's
no,
been
it's
multiple
not fake
interviews. Yeah. This is who he is.
It definitely is. This is, again, anybody that paid attention to Indiana, this is the kind of stuff he said. I don't know what for 47 seconds, he said nothing. He said nothing.
I tell you what, even if this man's NFL career doesn't work out, I have no doubt Fernando Mendoza is going to be extremely successful in the private wealth management field when his career is done.
Yeah, the Raiders have a banker as their quarterback, I think, moving forward. The Chiefs, I still think there's a chance the first game Mendoza starts is going to be against the Chiefs in Vegas.
That
what is that, October?
Job is still open, by the way.
I know Kubiak yesterday said they haven't decided. Anybody want to make a wager that it's not Mendoza week one? Kirk Cousins starting week one.
I think it is Kirk Cousins.
Aiden O'Connell played better yesterday than Fernando Mendoza did.
I think the earliest we see Mendoza, truly, and it makes, if you look at their schedule, I don't think they start and make his Raiders debut on the road. Like, I think it's Vegas. They want to lean it. I don't think they will have Mendoza make his debut on the road. So assuming Kirk stays healthy, if you look at their schedule after week one, it looks like the Chiefs Raiders game, October 4th or 5th, whatever it is. I think that might be the.
If I'm the Raiders, I'm not starting him against the Chiefs. I'm starting him against like the Jets.
But look at
they might have to wait all the way to November 1st, which is totally fine. Start him against the Jets.
It depends how well, Kirk Cousins plays. But here's the Raiders' start of the schedule. They open up against the Dolphins at home. Again, I think Kirk Cousins is starting. Week two, they go to LA to play the Chargers. That's not going to happen. Raiders at the Saints. I don't think they'll start him on the road. Chiefs Raiders, that's a home game October 4th. Then the Raiders go to the Patriots. Then they host the Bills and they host the Rams. Then they go to the Jets November 1.
Their season might be over by that.
Yeah,
point,
which then you might as well pivot to Mendoza. I just think the earliest we see Mendoza is Chiefs Raiders. And I think there's a decent chance that that's the week it happens if Cousins is struggling. I just don't think you have your number one overall pick in the draft end up starting his first ever Raiders game on the road. I think you do that at home if you can. I don't know. Maybe people view it differently. We'll talk more about this later. Up next, though, Jake Eisenberg from the Royals Radio Network will join us. We'll ask him about the sweep of the A's, but also the injuries that continue to pop up, including the latest for Michael Garcia. All right, back here on Cody and Gold, just getting started on a Friday. Alex Gold, Drew Nixon with you. Logan Weber is filling in for Cody today. Coming up in about 12 minutes, we'll get into Ben Johnson's comments with the Bears. Of course, talking about being the highest scoring offense, not only in football this year, but in NFL history. And so now we have some odds on who could end up being the highest scoring offense in 2026. Where do the Chiefs stack up and what is the realistic chances of that actually happening? So we'll get into some NFL again in just a little bit, but let's go out to the Golden Oak Lending phone line and welcome in our guy, Jake Eisenberg, of course, from the Royals Radio Network. The Royals getting set to open up a series against the Tigers tonight, fresh off a 4-game sweep of the A's. I think what the first time, Jake, since like 1994, were you born yet?
No, I was not born yet. I was born in 1995. So yeah, we saw something yesterday that hasn't happened in my lifetime. That's always fun.
It feels like, look, I don't want to downplay, there was certainly some impressive at-bats and pitching performances by the Royals, but man, watching this series, and I think you even said it on the broadcast, maybe on Tuesday night, the way that the eighth and ninth inning played out and ultimately the Royals coming back, it felt like the A's were doing their best a couple times there to just hand the game to the Royals too.
I mean, that's literally what Denny said the night of the walk-off. His call was, thanks, Athletics. And yeah, that is kind of how it felt. And look, you don't want to throw stones when you live in a glass house. You know, the A's have had their bullpen struggles this season, and the Royals took advantage. And, that's what teams that are better than other teams need to do. You take advantage of what the other team gives you.
We got Jake Eisenberg joining us here on 96.5 The Fan. Michael Garcia yesterday, it did not look good as he was rounding the bases. I think Hugh after the game acknowledged that this likely means he's headed to the IL. I guess, have you sensed in the clubhouse over the year just how frustrating these injuries have been as well? It's not just the number, but also there's been guys that have come back from injury and then had a new injury or re-injured the existing one.
Yeah, it's definitely frustrating. I think the sense that I get from the clubhouse is there's an understanding of, like, these things happen, frustrating as they are, and it's up to the guys that are in there and not on the injured list to go out there and compete and play hard and do their best to win every night and do their best until those other guys get back. There definitely was an infusion a couple of days ago when Vinny Pasquantino and Michael Garcia came off the injured list, and you saw this lineup that looked a heck of a lot like an opening day 2027 lineup, if you ask me, and you thought, man, Could you imagine what this would have looked like all year if like all these guys were in there together? And there definitely is a sense of that. And it's a shame, you know, with Garcia and watching him around third yesterday and now likely going on the injured list today. In that same vein, you know, Nick Lofton has really gotten a lot of run this year, you know, playing a lot of third base in Garcia's absence. He's been terrific. And I think that's a credit to him in stepping up when the opportunity has been there for him.
In terms of Mike Helms himself, you know, this team, even with the 5-game winning streak, 19 games under 500, this hamstring thing has been bothering him since May. I mean, it didn't put him on the IL until June, but if he goes back on the IL today, which Q said yesterday is likely, is this the last that we'll see of Mikel Garcia in 2026 in your view?
Yeah, that's hard to say. It's the other hamstring this time, so that is different. It's not connected to, you know, it was the right hamstring back in May, and now it's the left hamstring. So those are two separate injuries. We don't know the severity of this hamstring injury quite yet, so I think it's too early to say whether or not they'll be back, you know, in X number of days or X number of weeks.
We're talking to Jake Eisenberg here on 96.5 The Fan. We haven't talked to you since Noah Cameron came off that complete game outing, nearly a no-hitter, and once again, we see where he's stacked up in baseball over the last month or so. What's your view on Noah right now? We all know he starts to call his own games, and that's been a huge part of it, but it feels like there's got to be more to it than just that, where now, I think for 2027, there's more confidence among fans, perhaps, that he can have a significant role in the rotation.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think he was going to be a significant part of the 2027 rotation, regardless of what everybody, you know, thought. You're looking at 2027, the rotation right now as it stands is Waka, Lugo, Cameron, and then fill in the blank, you know, until other pitchers get back from injuries. We'll see. Is Randy Dobnak a part of that? Time will tell, depending upon what happens this offseason. You know, we'll see how it goes. Is Daniel Lynch the fourth a part of that? We'll see how that goes over the course of the rest of this season as he continues to get stretched out, and I think his last start was pretty encouraging too. As far as Noah's concerned, I think it sometimes maybe is as simple as confidence and conviction. At least that's sort of what he's proving, that when he can go out there and have that conviction and have that rhythm and that slider bites and that curveball drops and the fastball command is really good, when he puts all those pieces together, man, is he really good. And we saw flashes of that last year too, and we've seen flashes of it this year. We've also seen when it's gone awry a little bit this year and the command's been iffy and he gets behind in counts and then has to force, you know, pitches in the zone that then get hit. You know, that happens with every pitcher. We're seeing the best of Noah Cameron, and it's been really, really fun to watch. Really looking forward to tonight. You know, Noah Cameron, who's been on this incredible run against, you know, Troy Melton for the Tigers tonight, who's been the best pitcher in baseball since the All-Star break. I mean, that's a really good pitching matchup for a series opener.
As we're talking about guys that are playing tremendous baseball here in the month of August, Jack Caglione, I mean, as good as he was in June, he is putting that almost to shame with his play in August. He missed yesterday because of that right ankle soreness that took him out of the game two nights ago. Any expectation of him missing tonight's game, or should we expect him back in the lineup in right field?
Well, Matt Cotrero said that he was available off the bench yesterday, so it would not be entirely surprising to see him back in the starting lineup today, whether that's in right field, whether that's as a DH to keep him off his feet and off that ankle, maybe for another day more. We'll see. I will say that Q also said that this is an ankle soreness that kind of goes back to the road trip in LA, whether it was at Dodger Stadium or in Anaheim, and it didn't seem to slow him down all that much because he homered in Anaheim and had three hits and was still hitting, you know, still went 3-for-5 with a couple RBIs the other night too against the Athletics. I mean, this is just a torrid month. We're seeing him blossom into the superstar that the Royals knew he could be and that Jack knows that he is. Ever since he's been hitting third in the lineup, he's been among the best hitters in baseball. And when he comes to the plate, you expect him now to do damage. He is becoming a feared hitter, and that's been exciting to watch when he's, you know, wearing your uniform.
Last week, or I guess it would have been earlier this week, that the Royals made the move that Lucas Hursad getting sent down to Triple A. We all know it's been a struggle, to say the least, here in 2026, and we were discussing earlier in the week about just how quickly things have shifted for him compared to when he was first acquired. You've been around baseball a while, whether it's in the big leagues or in the minor leagues, and it's not the first time a player, whether it's a lack of confidence and needs to just get right in that regard, and has been able to bounce back. Are you looking at the rest of this season for in Omaha, just a sense of him being able to try to get some confidence to where next spring training he's able to maybe once again compete and get them something in that bullpen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen what Lucas Hursad can be and was for a Royals team that won a playoff series just 2 years ago. That doesn't go away, you know, instantaneously. That is in there. And what's happened this year, you know, is baffling, you know, from the strikeout rate going down, the swing and miss rate, the lack of command that, you know, we know that Lucas has certainly had when he came over to the Royals initially. That is still in there. And I think, you know, going to Omaha is a chance to hit the reset button, hit the refresh button, you know, get maybe a little bit away from results and a little bit back toward process in an environment where process is at the fore as opposed to results. It would not surprise me to see Lucas Hersek back in the big leagues with the Royals this season in maybe September when rosters expand and teams can add a couple more players. I wouldn't be surprised to see him back up, you know, after the couple of weeks of the option time runs out. Kind of depends on how it goes in Omaha, obviously, but
sure.
I think it's in the Royals' best interest to have Lucas Hersek find success in Omaha and then be back in the big leagues before the end of the season, and as opposed to go into the offseason, having finished the year in AAA, going into the offseason, having finished the year back in the big leagues, I think would be an important thing. Of course, the success is important too. You want to see the success in the big leagues after the success in AAA. That's paramount here. But I think that would be an important box to check.
It feels like in a year where the team's performing poorly, the positive storylines are kind of few and far between. And one of those positives that I feel like isn't being discussed enough is the play of Michael Massey. After yesterday's game, he goes 3-for-4. He's hitting almost 280 this year. He's got an OPS up over 750. I'm from your view, with the Jonathan India injury after the Royals traded for him a couple of years ago, when he comes back healthy, what does that mean for the future race for who the starting second baseman is for the Kansas City Royals? Is it still Jonathan India in your view, or has Michael Massey kind of played himself into that role as the everyday second baseman for Kansas City?
Well, Jonathan India is going to be a free agent at the end of this season. And I don't know that that's something that is part of the Royals plans. And I think even if that might've been, I think Michael Massey has certainly earned the fact that he is the Royals' second baseman, not just with the bat, but also defensively too. I mean, he's going to be a Gold Glove finalist this year and should be. I'm not sure if he's going to win a Gold Glove, but he should be a finalist this year. And that's obviously just with the glove. The defensive floor is so high, but you know, you make a great point at the plate too. You know, I think because he hits sixth, seventh, eighth in the lineup sometimes, you kind of overlook his contributions. But then when you take a look at them and you zoom out in the totality of it, he's got a career high in batting average right now. He's getting close to a career high in games played this year. He's tied his career high in runs scored. He's getting close to his career high in hits for a season. He's already got a career high in doubles. He's getting close to his career high in homers. He's getting close to his career high in RBIs. I mean, he has done everything this year as good or better than he has done his entire career. We are seeing what a fully healthy, comfortable, smooth Michael Massey is capable of, which I'll be candid. This is I've been a big Michael Massey fan and a big believer in Michael Massey's ability to have this kind of season for a while. The thing that's held him back is the injuries and, you know, kind of the unstructure of, you know, on the injured list, coming off the injured list, going like that has limited him in his ability to like really have that runway. Getting to play every day and seeing this and seeing the adjustments that he's made over the offseason and the adjustments that he's talked about making and that Alex Zumwalt has talked about him making in St. Louis back in May. These are real sustainable things that he's been doing. And he has been such a solid all-around player for this team this year. And I'm glad you highlighted him because I do not think he gets nearly the credit that he deserves.
Jake Eisenberg, Royals Radio Network, Royals Tigers tonight, 7:10 first pitch at the K. Noah Cameron on the bump right here on 96.5 The Fan. Thanks, Jake. Have a great weekend, man.
Hey, appreciate it, guys. Look, if there's one thing you can expect from tonight, it's a close game because the Royals and Tigers can't seem to figure out how to play a game that's not decided by two runs or one run or decided in the late inning. So all I'm saying is grab your popcorn, hold on to your butts. Like, we're going to have a good time tonight.
So the Royals are actually winning by 5 runs tonight is what I just heard. That's the jinxed it. That's exactly what's going to happen. Thank you, Jake.
Yeah, take care, guys.
There you go. There's Jake Eisenberg out on the Golden Oak Lending phone line. The trends say that, but you know how this goes. You have all the trends. You have everything that tells you a certain game is going to go a certain way, and then watch, tonight will be a blowout. Hopefully the Royals favorite. Thanks to Jake Eisenberg for joining us here, as he does each and every Friday at 10:30. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll talk with Matt Verderam from Sports Illustrated about some of the injuries for the Chiefs, but also bigger picture NFL items that are in the news this week, including a couple moves that happened around the National Football League. But Before we even get to some of the offenses around the league and the comments from Ben Johnson and some odds on the highest scoring offense, people are texting on the phone line about you. People are texting in talking about you. They want to know if I have seen a sandwich anytime soon. No, that's stopped. Logan got shamed on the air last time he filled in. Drew, he was with us, I don't know, what was that, 2 months ago? Probably back in actually, it would have been end of June was the last time you filled in for Cody. And at that time, we kind of had an intervention for you, and I feel like it worked.
It absolutely worked. It worked well before that. It worked the second time it happened, and that was the empty Culver's box that smelled like onions that I threw away in the trash can. That was the day it stopped, because I was woken up at, I don't know, 10:04 in the morning with a phone call from Drew.
Uh-huh.
It said, hey, can we bring you on really quick? We want to talk to you about something.
Waking up at 10 a.m.?
I do after hours at night, man.
I'm
not home till 10 p.m. Like, I stay up till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning playing video games.
That's not a late show. There's people that do that are on the air till 1 a.m. I used to do a show and I was on till midnight. That's it. You're off at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock.
But I get home and I wind down, watch TV, play video games for a few hours.
You're definitely a night person.
It was just, I'm definitely more of a night person. But you woke me up that morning and I'm thinking, like, oh, what is this, like a sports thing? I'm sitting there, like, racking my brain, like, why the hell these guys want me on? Drew said nothing. He gave me no inclination of what was about to happen, and you barreled right into did you leave food in the studio yesterday? And I'm like, I felt like that kid in the principal's office who just found out they're in trouble.
You were like, yes.
Yeah, like that feeling in the pit of my stomach. And I was like, oh my God, no, this is not. And so, like, ever since then, anytime anything gets left anywhere, I'm the first accused. Apparently there was a sandwich or something that was left in, like, the kitchen area here at the station. That wasn't me.
Yeah, we think it was.
Everybody thought it was me. People started taking it and running with it on the radio talk. I was like, that wasn't me. That absolutely did not happen, and I have not made that mistake since.
No, we never did. But no, I'm saying, you know, the good news is you haven't had it since. You haven't had a problem since, you know? People are also now just giving you a hard time about everything. You know how this goes. What about his Thanksgiving take?
Well, that was...
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll get to that maybe during Fan Club Friday. That needs to be more over some drinks and over 1 o'clock hour before we get
it
to Logan's
every time I'm
meat
on air.
Preferences.
Does it really?
Every time I'm on air, I got somebody in the text line asking show me your meat, bro, drop. And I'm like, good Lord.
I forgot about that
Come
one.
Come on, man.
That wasn't the one I was
thinking. That's not the one we were, yeah.
Can we please put things in context? Light or dark, I only care about meat in my mouth. Oh, my God.
That was you, man. That was all you. Anyway, let's talk about offenses in the NFL, shall we? We discussed Ben Johnson of the Bears, who said he wants to not only be the highest scoring offense this year, but he wants their offense to be the highest scoring offense in NFL history. Last year, the best offense in the NFL was the Rams. They made it to the NFC title game. Dallas and Detroit were in the top three. The Patriots actually were the fourth best offense. So there's odds out there at various books, whether you're looking at FanDuel, DraftKings, Circa, etc. And for the highest scoring team in football this year, no surprise, the team that was the highest scoring last year has the best odds with the same quarterback and an MVP quarterback. So the Rams are favorites, plus 550. Then you have the Bills 6-1, Lions 6.5-1, Cowboys up there, Bengals 9-1, Bears 9-1, Ravens 9-1. If you're wondering, the Chiefs are all the way down at 25-1 to be the highest scoring team in football. Now, look, I don't think the Chiefs are going to be the highest scoring team in football. I think their offense could be a lot better. They were also better in certain categories than people think if you look at the games which Mahomes actually started in. However, I don't think they're now going to just be the most dominant offense in football. They don't need to be, by the way. Just if they can get back to being one of the top 5 to 7 offenses, that'll be plenty enough, I think, with what I still think this overall unit is going to be as a team. But are you buying the Bills or the Lions there? Those are the two teams that I struggle with when I'm looking at who's going to be the highest scoring team in football. I get why the Rams are there as the favorite. Am I missing something with the Bills? And then I'm just skeptical on the Lions. Where are you out on both those? Because for Buffalo, Joe Brady, the OC, now is the head coach. They do go out and get DJ Moore, which I think is a very nice addition. James Cook is still there. I guess if you think their defense is going to struggle, they got to be in shootouts. Maybe that favors the Bills. I don't think the Bills wind up being the second highest scoring offense in football. Remember, they were not even in the top four last year. Is DJ Moore enough to make it to where the Bills are a top two, if not the best offense in football? I don't think so. And then the Lions at plus 650, I'm just kind of out on them a little bit. I'm skeptical about another year of not having Ben Johnson, and do they make enough adjustments. Dan Campbell took over play calling midseason last year. There's no David Montgomery anymore. It's all on Jahmyr Gibbs. Yes, they have Isaiah Pacheco, who comes in there, but I think we all saw, I don't know what he's going to add to that room. So I actually disagree with the teams after the Rams. I don't think the Bills and Lions will be one of the top two offenses in football.
I'm with you on the Bills. I disagree when it comes to the Detroit Lions. I look at their offense, first off, and people in the text line have kind of mentioned this, their defense isn't going to be as good. People saying they're going to be horrible. I don't know about that. I mean, you've got a decent enough secondary, even with the loss of Terrion Arnold. Solid linebackers with Jack Campbell, who was the linebacker of the year last year in the NFL. And I mean, getting Aiden Hutchinson back. So I look at that and I think that the defense is going to be okay, but the offense still has just a ridiculous amount of weapons. Amon-Ra St. Brown, who many people think could have a top five fantasy season at the wide receiver group this year. I still have a lot of belief in Sam Laporta. Maybe it's because I'm a biased Iowa fan. I don't know. But I think if he can stay healthy, he can kind of bounce back and get closer to that rookie tight end form that we saw from him, along with Jameson Williams and Isaac Tesla. And I think the loss of David Montgomery is going to make Jahmyr Gibbs better. I think that he's going to be less wary of the fact that he's going to get pulled in certain situations. There were so many instances, and we've seen it with the Rams the last couple of years with Kyren Williams and Blake Corum, of you see Jahmyr Gibbs do his thing all the way down the field, and then when they get inside the 10-yard line, it's David Montgomery time. And the fact that Jahmyr Gibbs is going to have the keys to the kingdom as the running back in that offense, Jared Goff, I mean, he was a top five quarterback in football last year from a statistical standpoint.
Things have to be like we talk about this with the Lions offensive line injuries. It goes for a lot of quarterbacks, but specifically him because he's a pocket passer. The timing has to be perfect. The offensive line has to play at a high level. He's as much of a pocket passer as any quarterback in football. When things are perfect and the timing's right and his wide receivers are on, he's great. Yeah, he's a top five quarterback at times in the league statistically.
Right.
I just worry about when things break down, and I don't know if their offensive line is going to be good enough this year.
And if there's one thing, and I agree with that, if there's one thing I know about Dan Campbell, though, we all know about Dan Campbell, the guy's a gambler, right? He is he's going to just throw the balls out and say, here we go. There's going to be shots down the field. There's going to be trick plays. He's either going to allow Jared Goff to throw for touchdowns or pick sixes. He really doesn't care. Points are getting scored one way or the other because he is just going to roll the dice. And I think that kind of plays into being a high scoring offense. You know, they may give up the most points in terms of defensive touchdowns of any team in football at the same time, but the Lions are going to do their thing. At the end of the day, though, I'm with you. I think the Rams are the odds on favorite, should be the odds on favorite with the weapons that they have. The problem I have with Los Angeles and what slows me down with them a little bit is Stafford's a little bit older, and I don't know what's going to happen now with the whole Puka Nacua situation. His court dates moved back. There's all these reports coming out of the NFL is not going to wait that long for a suspension if they feel there's one that they deem necessary. So if Puka Nacua misses time, that's going to kind of put a hitch in your giddy up if you're the Los Angeles Rams offense.
Yeah, the Rams, by the way, they open up. If he ends up missing time, the Rams open up against the Niners in Australia. Then they have the Giants, the Broncos, the Eagles, the Bills, the Cardinals. That's the first couple weeks of the season for them. The team that honestly, from a pure betting angle, that was interesting to me on this list was Cincinnati at 9-1. We all know, even when the years where their defenses have struggled, the offense has not been a problem. I guess the only argument of not betting Cincy for the highest scoring team this year would be if the defense actually improves enough, is there less of the, hey, we got to go and score every drive, and maybe that hurts your case. That would be the only hesitation, but I still think we know what we're getting for the most part with that offense. The question would be is if the defense is better, and does that lead to them just simply not having to score 35 points?
I think them in Baltimore would be good value because I'm looking back. Lamar was like Joe Burrow. He didn't play every game last year. In 2024, the Ravens had the third best scoring offense behind the Bills and the Lions, and Lamar was fully healthy. And I think that I don't know if Derrick Henry's another year older, but at the same time, I feel like even with a new head coach and a new OC, it feels like the way that the Ravens do their thing is it's you can almost replace the OC in there, and it's not like there's that much of a difference, I suppose, in how they do things. I think the Ravens would be good. I think they have the same value, right, as the Bengals in this. I close
yeah, both 9-1.
So I either one of those, obviously, because both quarterbacks would be healthy and offenses have been very prolific.
What about the Patriots? I feel like we're talking. People talk.
They were up there last year. They were fourth.
They were fourth last year. Yeah.
In terms of score, yeah.
The schedule is the biggest argument, right? Like, I still think Drake May is going to have a nice year. I know in the playoffs it was not a good look for him, but I don't think last year was fluky for them. But I do wonder, the schedule being worlds more difficult, how does that impact where the offense is at? You know, that would be the only hesitation. But no, they had at least proven with a lot of the same pieces that they were a top five unit.
And they got AJ Brown now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they lose Stephon Diggs, but they replace him. I think they get a slight upgrade in AJ Brown if he can stay off of social media and start arguing with his coaches.
All right, coming up next, we'll continue going around the NFL a little bit with Matt Verderam from SI. We'll also get his thoughts on the Chiefs preseason game tomorrow, including what he's expecting from Mansoor Delane. That's coming up here on 96.5 The Fan.